I was a heavy equipment operator by trade, and I ran into some physical issues medically, and became out of work, and it circumstantially became actually suicidal at a point in time. And I made that phone call, got the help I needed, and was turned on to some programs that were being provided at the Center for Mental Health for people in fresh out of crisis situations like myself. And they did just a wonderful job. I mean, I was attending the Empowerment Center for about 2.5 years after I did an intake with me. They suggested that I do that and another class that's called DBT, which is Dialectical Behavioral Therapy, which provided me with just a whole toolbox of coping skills. And I've become more involved since then as a volunteering for the Center of Mental Health, and got my hands in just about everything there, and just done a wonderful job for me. It's all due to a phone call that I made to the emergency services department, and here I am, living proof that it works.
So we're here today to talk about the resources that the Center for Mental Health provides, but we wanted to really focus on what is out there for men in particular. Can you tell me why there's sort of a special effort on the part of the center to reach out to men right now?
Men are the highest rate of suicide in the country. And it's the working age men between the ages of 25 and 54. We at the center got a grant through the State Office of Suicide Prevention to promote Man Therapy, which is a website, mantherapy.org, that men can go onto and in the privacy of their own home access things like depression, anger, stress, anxiety. It's just an incredible website that you could spend about 40 minutes on, and it's based on humor. They took 2 years of finding out what really a man wanted, and it's to target those men that you cannot reach any other way that won't reach out for help.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, it meets men where they're at, and it just shows that it's, you know, to reach out for help is not a sign of weakness, but it's actually a sign of strength.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
yeah, I took a look at the site, and there's this manly man in his study, you know, that gives you a tour of the site, and it's humorous, but it's also, you know, definitely full of resources, and there are testimonials from men who did have to seek help. I thought it was a really interesting way to put the information out there.
Yeah, the actor is fictitious, but the information is definitely very real, and he stays interactive with you the whole time. So if you don't push a button, he'll start filleting a fish. it's pretty fun. It's a very high content website, so some people might have to wait for it to download, but hopefully the majority of the people can just go right through it.
Cameron, I wanted to ask you, when you were suffering from depression, what kept you from seeking help, and how long did you know?
I was feeling in that situation for about a month and a half, and I was proud and didn't want to admit that I had this problem going on, and I was really apprehensive of trying to seek help, but it rode on me and rode on me, and it brought me to the point where it was next to my only option. The other option was to go ahead and commit, and I found I knew where the Center for Mental Health was, drove down there to get some help one morning as I had the gun in my hand, and I decided not to do it, and I put the gun back away, and I got in my car and drove down to town. I was living in Eckerd at the time, and I got to the old mental health building up across from the Delta Memorial Hospital, and they had moved, and I got the address, drove down to there, and when I got there, it must have been a Saturday morning because it happened to be closed, and I got the number. It was right there on the door for the suicide prevention hotline, and sat right there in tears and called that number, and they provided me with some awesome treatment, and what it took was for me to decide to make that phone call. I had to put my pride behind me, just man up, and admit that I had problems that I couldn't fix by myself. I would recommend if anyone's even anywhere near a crisis situation, having some thoughts, 252-6220 saved my life, and it just took for me to make that simple phone call. Just swallow that pride for a minute and make that call. If you're feeling that way and you're too proud to talk to your friends or your families about it and you're isolating yourself, think about what I just said about that phone call, and it's all it takes is to make that call.
What kinds of evaluations and screenings do you go through when you do make that call? What happens?
Well, the hotline people told me that they would meet me at the emergency room because obviously the center was closed, so I agreed, went up there, and they they came and did some questioning and evaluating with me just on site immediately, and they decided that I was definitely needed to go up to Colorado West and Grand Junction was where they do their evaluations. And I went up there for about a 72-hour evaluation, and they sent me in the right direction from there. But that's what it took. The treatment was to just to take a ride up to Junction and be there for 3 days. And let me tell you, it was one of the most valuable 3 days that I can reflect upon that I've had in my life.
So what kinds of services are available to people who don't have any money? And I don't know if you were in that situation, but...
I was definitely in that situation. I had no insurance. My previous medical problem had caused me to lose my job, and therefore I had no insurance. And, of course, I was broke, having just come out of also a substance abuse situation. They provided me with a sliding scale based on your income, and they worked really well with me, and I ended up being able to obtain my Medicaid, Medicare after filing for a disability case, and which I've gotten some help from them with that. And their sliding scale pretty much allowed me to retain the service.
We accept most major insurances. We have a contract with Medicaid. We do accept Medicare. Of course, self-pay people. And how we determine those fees, we have two programs. One is a sliding scale fee, which is based off of your annual household income and also the number of people that live in your household. And then we assess your fee from there. The other option is what we call our uninsured benefit package. And that's something new to our agency within the last year or so, where we take someone who has no insurance at all, and we kind of provide them with our own insurance that we developed through our company, where it's good for 6 months. And it gives them cheaper fees than it would on the sliding scale fee, but it's for 6 months. And you get 6 individual counseling sessions with that. Your first appointment, your evaluation, your mental health assessment is your first appointment. You get that. You have your first intake, your mental health assessment, and then you can also see the psychiatrist for whatever your assessed fee is, and follow-up appointments for whatever your assessed fee is, and then your 6 individual sessions, unlimited group sessions during that 6 months, unlimited case management services, and unlimited emergency services. So then at 6 months, we reassess if we need to continue. But those are our options right now for people who don't have insurance that covers them.
Robin, when I was talking to you before the interview, you were mentioning that you were hoping that you could really get the word out to coal miners. Can you tell me why?
Absolutely. Well, because our focus is on men and the working age men. That's such a huge population in this area. So I've set up a couple of trainings that'll happen next month. One will be at the Paonia Library on Thursday, February 21st, from 1:30 to 2:30. And these are suicide prevention trainings. And then another one will happen in Delta, actually the day before, February 20th, from 10:30 to 11:30. And just hoping that we can get minors, that we can get their supporting family members to come. It'll be open to anybody and everybody.
Is there something about that job or the culture in that profession that is, I guess, tough to deal with?
Well, sure, there could be their problems at home. Could be problems that they come across with health and issues of the mines. They close down for sometimes. They have, of course, the long wall moves always put a few guys out of work for a couple of weeks or so. And basically, life can drive anybody to that point where they're going to be needing some help. And mm-hmm. We'd like to provide the resources for them to get that help.
Well, and coal miners are such a huge part of where we're at in our area. I mean, it's one of, you know, a big source of employment. And so we have a ready-made group of men who chances are one in four could possibly have some sort of mental illness, whether it's temporary or whether it's something that's more long-term for them. So it's just a population that, you know, where we go back to the man therapy, do men seek help as often as maybe they should? And my guess is probably not. So, you know, it's just a ready-made population of people that we know probably could really benefit from something that we have to offer.
Because their image that they're projecting, they will be the ones that are more reluctant to ask for help.
Right.
And these trainings that are provided are really designed to help you with increase your awareness. And if you use these trainings, it may be on somebody that for somebody that you know, it could be a loved one, or it could be pertaining to feelings of your own. So it's for one person, it could finger out to many people. Like one person may get a little bit of help for it, and somebody says, "Well, I've had similar situation like that, and I did this." And next thing you know, there's someone else that's received some help and some training on learning how to recognize signs of somebody that's nearing or is definitely in a crisis situation.
Cameron,
and they're too proud to say. So if somebody else recognizes it, questions them, persuades them to ask for help, and then we turn them on to the resources to get that help. That's the whole of that training right there. It could be a loved one that you spend a little time with, and you could just definitely save their life. It could be a friend, or you may find a stranger you come across that needs exactly what you're able to provide.
Yeah.
I know I've talked with, or I've had more than one of the coal mines in the area, their human resources person call me and ask me questions. Here's kind of the situation, not naming names, but what is available? What can we do? How can we help this person deal with this issue, whatever it might be? You know, the number of people who do access services, who do work for the coal mines, both male and female. You know, so I think it's just a big population that
you just want to let them know you're here.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
and married to a coal miner.
You
myself,
are?
Uh-huh. You know, there's things that I hear that I think, oh, that sounds like depression to me. Like maybe if your foreman's who are working with the hired hands or the hourly guys, you know, maybe they need a little more information about what they're seeing on their crew, because what you're just telling me, sweetheart, sounds an awful lot like this problem. This person has something with depression, or maybe they have an alcohol problem, and, you know, are they at risk themselves or putting everyone else at risk? You know, just things like that I recognize is it's a big need, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. We just want to create more of a safety net for themselves and for their families. And
yeah, and I feel like their industry, too, is a little bit, it's sort of hard to figure out what's going to happen all the time. It must be hard to be working in a job where you not only do you not know what's going to happen at your particular mine, but you don't even really know what's going to happen with the entire industry.
Right. And there are long hours, and it's underground. Yeah. And so if you're prone to depression and you're spending in the wintertime, a lot of time in the dark.
Demanding in very, very many ways.
Right. So I wanted to talk a little bit about just the mental health system in the U.S. Many of the shooters that were in these mass shootings that have taken place, some of them were, you know, mentally ill, obviously, and some of them were even being treated. Yet somehow they weren't prevented from doing what they did. So I think there's a lot of attention on our mental health system right now. Can you tell me what you think needs to happen in our country so that we're taking care of people better? I know that's a huge question, but you work in this industry, so
I'll give it my best shot.
Okay.
and first, I just want to clarify that it's very difficult for us, and anyone for that matter. I mean, we are not in the business of predicting human behavior. We are in the business of helping people function better in their lives, live more meaningful lives, be safe, whether that's a danger to themselves or to others, and changing behaviors. And that's kind of where our duties lie. So, you know, with what type of improvements can we do, you know, nationwide as a mental health, you know, we have to be, and I assume this is happening. I know it happens in our agency, but we're constantly assessing for, is someone a danger to themselves? Is someone a danger to others? You know, we're constantly asking that. We assess for that every session. And if those are things that are there, if, you know, we have to assess the level of the plan and do we have, say, for instance, of people who are threatening harm, if they share that with us, because oftentimes that they may or may not be shared because they know ahead of time that we have to report that, we have to warn someone, we have to take certain steps, and they're aware of that. So if they are sharing that with us, or if we suspect it, you know, we're asking the right questions, and then once we ask the right questions, following up with what are the steps we need to do to keep this person safe and the community safe. As far as improving those things, as far as stopping them on our end, it's predicting human behavior is, I mean, it's just never.
Well, I think it's going to mean more money trickling down to mental health too. I mean, we have no psychiatric hospital, you know, other than Grand Junction, which has 34 beds, I believe. So it's really, really a sad situation when you're in a rural community and there's not. But 90% of those who complete suicide have a mental illness, and then I was hearing the other day that 60% of those who have a mental illness don't reach out for treatment. Mm-hmm. So you're talking a large population that's not reaching out.
And I personally feel with this whole thing that's built up about gun control, if they would put just a portion of the money and interest that they're dumping into this gun control thing, if they would put that over into the mental health issues, it would be so monumental to what's going on with everybody.
It seems like it must get a little tricky, too, in the area where you in a sense, have to take people's rights away from them to protect them or other people. So the legalities of it must be very tricky when it gets to that point where you know.
Yeah. And that we can only take them away for so long. Even if someone is a danger to others, there's only so long that we can have them in the hospital under constant supervision before they're doing better and hopefully get out and then getting the appropriate treatment as follow-up. But yeah, I mean, the legalities of it are very, very tricky.
It's estimated that 30% of the people in the United States will have either a mental health issue at some point in their life or an addiction issue at some point. And I imagine, you know, it's hard to tell because how many people actually seek the help and right. get recorded in yeah. these kinds of.
And a lot of times it's just a case of getting on medication that helps balance out the chemicals in the brain. I mean, it's not really that incredible rocket science that could make you feel better. And, you know, the therapy along with the medication could just be the answer.
Do you think that that some of the drugs are overprescribed?
No, I just know for my family history, my father dealt with bipolar, what they call manic depression. Mm-hmm. And eventually, you know, down the road where he got to where he couldn't even get out of bed, he was able to get on, actually went to the doctor for the first time and got on lithium and was on it for about 7 years. And now he's 85 and he's just, you know, he's off of all medication. He's doing great. So sometimes it's just a matter of that.
Just getting someone stabilized, kind of.
I could also say, too, that I know, you know, having worked closely with a lot of our prescribers who are either psychiatrists or, you know, or advanced practicing nurse practitioners, that they aren't going to prescribe something that's not necessary.
Yeah, there's no recklessness.
Yeah. And it's not we just give you what you want, you know. If they prescribe something, it's because somebody needs it. And there's therapeutic benefits behind why they're prescribing those medications. And so sometimes it takes us a little bit of time to make sure that someone is getting that right balance.
Just by making those adjustments.
Yeah, but they're not careless at all and definitely only prescribe something that somebody really needs. We know that through research that the best outcome for certain disorders like depression, a combination of medication management and therapy, psychotherapy of some sort, gets the best outcome results. You know, they get over the depression faster with longer lasting results.
Do you think that the drugs are mostly prescribed to sort of give a balance to some sort of chemical imbalance that's happening? Or because it seems like, how would you know if that was happening?
How is that diagnosed? Again, you're not a psychiatrist, right. And only psychiatrists can do that. But right.
So, you know, they start with that mental health assessment, and that's where we go through a clinical interview, and, you know, we do diagnose them typically in that assessment. And then what the psychiatrist does is the psychiatrist, before prescribing any medications, does another evaluation anywhere from an hour and a half, depending on the particular doctor, again, to reevaluate the symptoms and make sure that they meet the criteria. Some people only need to be on medications for a short time frame, you know, until they get those levels restored, and then we wean them off, and sometimes they don't need medications. And then there's some people who need to be on a psychotropic medication for longer periods, and some people who need to be on them off and on their whole life, and then some people who remain on them. So it kind of depends on the course of their illness, the longevity of their illness, how long it dates back to, if it's like a one-time thing and it's like an episode that they had, is an episodic illness, or are they a long-term someone who has a mental illness that is suffering.
What do you recommend to people who are depressed? I mean, once they've been through the Center for Mental Health, what are some of the things that you tell people to do outside of counseling? Like, what makes people feel better, yeah. I guess?
Well, and I'm a huge advocate of wellness living, you know. So for me, when outside of what we would do with them at the center, I advocate for people to live a balanced lifestyle, eat right, get enough sleep, get exercise every day. You know, exercise done regularly is just as effective as a mild antidepressant, or an antidepressant for moderate depression, excuse me. So, you know, making time for your spiritual needs, your social needs, getting all those areas fulfilled and balanced so that one's not outweighing the other. And doing things that make them happy. Do things you enjoy, even if you don't think you enjoy it. Go to that family dinner anyways, even though you don't think you want to go. You know, you'll start to kind of fake it till you make it. But for me, it's about living a wellness lifestyle that they can do outside that's always going to help them feel better. If you're physically sick, you mentally don't feel well. Well, if you're mentally dragged down, you start to physically get dragged down.
Seek out that person you feel comfortable talking to, and it, you know, a family member or friend, and talk.
Mm-hmm. There are also groups that are provided, discussion groups. Mm-hmm. So you can sit down. Like, I facilitated Depression Bipolar Support Alliance, right. Both in Montrose and Delta, which is DBSA, Depression Bipolar Support Alliance. And the people are allowed to come in. It's a free service. They come in for an hour and a half meeting. I do one Monday night in Montrose and one Tuesday mornings in Delta, where they can sit down and we go through books that teach you how to identify if you're having anxiety, fears, your depression, help you to break down and learn how to manage your emotions, learn to see triggers coming, and turn you on to ways to divert, you know, to kind of ditch these triggers. You know, don't you see it coming, do something to get out of its way.
I also encourage my clients to get some education. You know, you were just diagnosed with major depression. What does that mean? I mean, it means a lot to me because that's what I studied and that's what I look at every day. But how's that going to affect you, and what do you know about it? And go out and get some knowledge, because knowledge is really powerful.
Yeah. Here's another big question. Why do you think the rates of depression are rising?
I personally feel like we're just getting better at recognizing that it's there. I don't know if I personally feel like it's any more prevalent than it was in the past, but that more people feel more comfortable getting treatment for it, coming forward, and we're getting better at detecting it. And of course, the sooner we detect it, anything, whether it's depression, anxiety, or whatever it might be, the sooner we can get help, obviously, the better the outcomes are. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think when I talk to people, they're always think that depression is the most common mental illness. Well, and actually, it's anxiety. Anxiety is the number one most prevalent mental illness in the United States. And there's several different forms of anxiety. But, you know, even more so, depression is a close second. But anxiety is more prevalent than depression. So
to answer another part of your question, I feel in this area something that's really triggering the men to become depressed, anxious. things are partially the economy to begin with, the foreclosure rate in the area, the men that are struggling to hold jobs, which they're not, you know, if you lose your job, chances are that nobody's going to even take that position because they're not hiring or something, but that would create depression in many forms with many different men. They have families at home that they have to provide for. They just got a new truck. Next thing you know, they lost their job. Their mortgage payment's coming up. Their truck payment's coming up. The kids are, you know, it creates a lot of stress. It just mounts up to the point where it'll drive an individual down to the point where some rational decisions.
For anyone who might want to learn more about mental illnesses in general, there's a 12-hour training course done over 2 days called Mental Health First Aid. And it basically teaches people who aren't therapists that, or have any sort of degree in psychology or counseling or anything or social work, but teaches them, how do I respond to someone who's that might be in a crisis? You know, so basically I think of it as being equivalent to basic first aid. And at the end of that course, you're a certified mental health first aider. But, you know, it allows you to intervene with someone who might be depressed. What do you do? What do you do with someone who's suicidal? What do you do with someone you think who might have an eating disorder or have anxiety? And so we teach you warning signs and symptoms and then how to respond and then where to go to from there. And it's a great educational training piece for people who are interested in just learning more about mental illnesses in general. And then how do I help someone if I come across it? Because one in four people in any given time in the U.S. have a mental illness. So, you know, that's 25% of our population. So the likelihood of someone coming across someone who could be suffering from a mental illness is very high. Mm. And can you be of service? Can you be of help to get them in the right direction?
Right.
So it's a great training.
When is it and where?
Well, I really encourage communities and groups to get together and call the center and ask for Stacy. Actually,
we put them on as we need to. You know, if you have a group of people, we'll throw together a training.
You know, if you feel that you need some help, go ahead and make that call. It's, again, emergency crisis line. It's 252-6220, 24 hours. I'm living proof. It was simply that phone call that saved my life.
Well, thank you, Cameron. Thanks for joining us, Stacy, Robin.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having all of us.